This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've mentioned before, and I'll say it again. When someone is on the ballot, we would love to have them on this program so you can learn about them before you have to decide whether you want to cast a vote for them. And in this next conversation, we have a candidate for the 137th New York State Assembly District. Damon Meeks is the incumbent. He's running for re-election. He's running against Willie Lightfoot. We reached out to both campaigns. Unfortunately, did not hear back from the Lightfoot campaign. And so we only have Damon Meeks with us, who is with us in studio. Assemblymember Meeks, welcome back. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me here, Evan.
You know, I know that this is, you are the incumbent, but it is important, I think, for listeners to understand who you are and why you decided you're running again. So why don't you tell them a little bit about your background, your career that led into your assembly work, and then why you decided, yes, I'm going to run for re-election.
Well, my background stemmed from community work, grassroots community organizing. I did that for some years, and then I became a labor organizer with 1199 SEIU. I did great work there as well. As far as motivation and what brought me here, all too often I just felt that in my community there were a number of needs that I felt that I can advocate in a certain type of way to bring those resources home. Also, as a labor organizer, more often than not, when I was at the table negotiating labor contracts, matters would come back to what's happening at the state level or not. And it had a direct impact on not only my community, but also the members that I represented in the labor union as well. So things sort of came full circle. Saw an opportunity following my predecessor, David Gantt, announcing that he would be retiring. And I decided to, run for office. You know, it was interesting because it was one of those things where, you know, I remember having conversations with some of our leaders in the labor movement. And there was one conversation that sort of went like, hey, so, you know, where's the assemblyman at on your race? I'm like, well, I think he already has a candidate. Well, where's the current mayor on your race? I said, well, the candidate is one and the same. And he dropped the F-bomb on me. He said, what are you doing? I'm like, well, we're running and we're going to win. And, you know, when you have a heart for this community and you commit to being actively engaged and not losing sight of why you're here and the community that you serve and those who played a major part in assuring that you were in this seat. You know, when I first ran for office,
back in 2020?
Yeah, back in 2020.
Yeah.
You know, I can say that, you know, two-thirds of the resources that, as far as monetary resources, came from family, friends, community. And then the other third, which was a little slow to warm up, was labor, you know, now that's not the case. But, you know, I was really excited to be in this role. I felt that in the first 2-3 years, we've been able to accomplish some great feats as it relates to the clean slate legislation. We just passed legislation assuring that those who are dependent on insulin, you know, come 2025 won't have to pay out of pocket. Like, that would be the responsibility on the insurance companies. And looking at different situations that exist in our community, such as grandparents raising children, raising grandchildren, and having to decide between feeding a child, paying certain bills, and paying for their medical needs. So we're looking at ways that we can also help you know, communities in that light. And as a delegation, I have an awesome team. You know, we have 2 members in the Senate and 4 of us in the Assembly. And I often speak to we and what we've been able to accomplish. We've been intentional in working together. Do we agree on 100% of things? Absolutely not. But when we're in session, come Thursday mornings, we're on a Zoom call together, if not in each other's presence. And we're talking about what can we do collectively to the benefit of this community that we serve. And I think that speaks volumes to the representation that we currently have. It's even to the point where we've received compliments from other members in government. Like, wow, you know, I'm amazed at how you all work well together. And in doing so, we're able to bring home those resources to announce an $8.1 $1 million towards Baden Street, to announce $1 million plus towards the Lincoln Branch Library and bring those type of upgrades, millions of dollars towards downtown. And I often hear folks say things such as, well, yeah, they're bringing the money here, but who's getting it? Well, I think we all have a responsibility to advocate in that manner. One of the things that I advocated on behalf of was when Teen Empowerment secured the money for their new building on Genesee Street. We need individuals from this community to do some of the work on this building. And you look at the great masonry work that has been done, and I can actually reach out to the individuals who were born and raised in the city of Rochester, attended Rochester City School District, that actually helped build that building and that space there. And that's commendable. It also gives one a sense of pride. I often speak about like my family's history, Van Ocker Housing over off of Ford Street. My grandfather, who is no longer with us, he helped build that. And that's part of the Meeks family pride. And for those individuals that helped build that building right there on Genesee Street, they can point to that, to their children or future generations, and say, hey, you know, your dad, you know, your granddad, you know, your great-granddad helped build that building there.
Talking to Demond Meeks, who is running for re-election, it's votedemondmeeks.com is the website. We invited his opponent, Willie Lightfoot, and did not hear back. It is not easy to be a newcomer to politics and have powerful office holders cursing at you in private, telling you it's not your time, telling you to get off the stage. Well, now you are the incumbent. You're running for re-election. And, you know, I mean, my personal view is I think primaries can be healthy for parties. I don't think they're unusual, but they don't always necessarily happen. Sometimes they do. And in this case, your opponent is Willie Lightfoot. I'm sure you know him well. You know, we've had him on the program a number of times. I hope we can talk to him again. Do you think this is a healthy primary? Are you surprised that he's running? I mean, like, how did this all come about in your mind?
That's interesting. That's a great question. And, you know, I honestly don't know how it came about. I was surprised. And in politics, you often find yourself saying, well, nothing surprises me anymore. But, you know, I've been intentional in, you know, having conversations with Willie. To this day, I see Willie. I've seen him at the Memorial Day parade and spoke to him. Thank you for your service. You know, he served in the military, and I commend him for that. So I'm not sure where it came from, because I'm of the mindset that there's a need for a community to come together and work together collectively. You know, being a representative, born and raised in the city of Rochester, and being an African-American male, there's certain things that our communities deal with, certain disparities that we see and deal with on a daily basis, that I think the way to truly transform them, yes, doing the work, but also a collective movement. And the way that collective movement looks is, okay, well, Demond, we have you here. Well, it starts with the people. Having that conversation with members of the community, saying, hey, these are what we deem as the issues. This is what we can achieve at the city level of government. This is what we can achieve at the county level. This is what we can achieve at the state level. This is what we can achieve at the federal level of government. And you bring those issues together, and then you begin to move and work. But that's part of like my background as a labor organizer, looking at issues and coming up with a strategy to achieve those. I believe that God will prepare you for what's to come. So with my background being labor organizing, grassroots community organizing, I find I don't have the luxury of simply being an assemblyman. An assemblyman is one who is responsible for making laws that govern the state, introducing legislation that govern the state, and also advocating for part of that $236 billion budget. It's one thing to advocate, but I find myself being in a position where you also have to advocate within the community. You have to talk to those who are receiving these monies to say that, hey, we need individuals who are directly impacted by these issues to be at the table with you as it relates to what's the next steps in spending these resources. Some would think that members of the community see the monies coming and will be able to galvanize around that and let the voices be heard. But I also believe that everyone may not know the next step. So I have to take on that responsibility
sure.
as well.
Sure.
I'm one that believe when your plate get full, sometimes you have to pray to God for a larger plate or even a second plate, but keep persevering.
Talking to Damon Meeks, and there's a number of issues that obviously are central to your campaign and your work. We've talked about them. We did recently, but I want to hit on a couple of them because this is part of your campaign interview here. And one of the key tenets that you have at VoteDamonMeeks.com is quality health care for all.
Yes.
What's the form that that looks like? What do you want to see change?
I would love to see universal health care for everyone.
At the state level, New York State?
You know, I introduced a bill, A3115, and that bill calls for the highest wage earning New Yorkers, those who are making $25 million plus a year, to pay a bit more. I believe they have more disposable income, and if they can commit a bit more, or if we held them accountable to pay more, we would be able to move a number of different social programs that are needed in our community. I worked as a labor organizer for 10 years. I remember being in facilities and talking to, you know, my members who would show up to work, and I posed the question, why are you at work? Like, I can see that you don't feel good right now. I can see that you're sick. Why are you here at work? I can't afford to be sick. And that's the story of so many people in our community. You know, when we look back at the pandemic and the spread and, you know, how it spread so rapidly, so many of those things were out of our hands. But even as it relates to a cold, a flu, people are going to work sick on a daily basis because in their situation, they just cannot afford to be sick or ill. So I think that, you know, if folks didn't have the stress of worrying about how they're going to pay for their medical expenses, I think it would also save us money in a number of ways. You know, have so many people that their primary care physician is the emergency room. And when they don't feel good and when they get worse and worse, they eventually go to that emergency room. And I think that we have to be intentional in pushing back against that. Thankful for some of the labor unions that are out there that allow individuals to have really quality health care, but everyone doesn't work a union job.
So just last hour, we're fresh off a conversation with one of your Republican colleagues in the legislature, Stephen Hawley, who told us that even if you're just raising taxes at the top level, like you described it, the wealthiest New Yorkers, the seven-figure earners and more, that the climate is so negative to business growth, to growth at all in the state, that any tax increase would further cripple New York State, in his words. You're saying, no, the highest earners, the very, very highest, can afford to pay more, and we can get better health care for everyone as a result here. What do you make of your colleagues who say, you're driving people away, you're hurting the business climate, it's not what New York State needs?
Well, when you look during the pandemic, I mean, we saw the increase in millionaires in New York State grow astronomically. When you look at those to this day that are upping and leaving our communities, it's individuals who just can't afford to live here. And those are like everyday working people. Sometimes it's middle class, oftentimes it's working poor that, you know, pack up and return to other states. A number are going to the South because they find it easier to live there. So, I mean, New York State is expensive in a number of ways, and there are some challenges, but I think one of the areas that we've made some good strides in is in healthcare, but I think we can do much better. That's why we voted to increase funding to some of the safety net hospitals, as well as increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate. We found that, you know, that it is a major challenge when you have Medicaid paying 70 cents on a dollar in comparison to other insurance companies. So I think those things make a difference, and it would also allow those institutions to have quality staffing as well. Again, I'll say it, these things come full circle where you have facilities that are understaffed. You may have mom who worked from 7 to 3. She thinks she's punching out at 3 o'clock, and the nurse manager says, hey, you can't punch out right now. We need you to stay on. We need you to stay on because, you know, there was a call off, or this person isn't feeling good from the last shift that they work, and you've been mandated. Well, what happens to that latchkey kid from the hours of 3 to 11 p.m.? So I think when we talk about properly funding things such as healthcare, calling for living wages, and a higher quality of life, those are things that I deem as anti-violence initiatives. You know, you want to keep the young man or the young woman out of gang activity and gang involvement, allow their family to be present and to provide for them on a 40-hour work week, and then to be present after that work shift.
Economic justice is another tenet. Is a living wage, in your words, part of economic justice?
Absolutely.
What is a living wage then?
So I couldn't give you the exact amount now. I know before the onset of the pandemic, $18.50 was the number for a single parent raising two children in Rochester. I would take it that is definitely beyond $20 now. But people being able to afford to live in their community and somewhat comfortable and to be able to provide for their family. You know, right now you look at challenges as it relates to housing insecurity as well as food insecurity. So looking at those challenges, we've been intentional in passing legislation and securing funding in those spaces. You may hear the commercials on Double Up Food Bucks. We're able to do that by way of state funding. We secured $2 million from the state, which was matched by another $2 million by way of the federal government. So when individuals, you know, use the Food Link curbside market, some of the farmer markets, it's beneficial not only to members of our urban community, but also to the farming communities in the rural parts of our state.
Got time for a few more questions for Assemblymember Meeks. It's votedemonmeeks.com if you want to learn more. Education is near the top of your list. And, you know, this is an area that you and I talked about on Connections recently. Governor Hochul maybe didn't win this one with the legislature to the extent that we look at funding, you know, different initiatives. But what exactly would you want listeners to know about where you are in education and what you want to do next in Albany there?
So I think, you know, the governor was on point when she pushed the initiative for reading. I think that's a major struggle and a major challenge in our school systems. But it's looking at some of the resources that existed some time ago and basically like keeping a log. I think back to like one of my track coaches that used to say you have to keep a mental and a written log on the highs and the lows. And I think those are the type of things that we have to revisit as a community and as a state. You know, what are some of the programs that we find that are thriving? When you look here in the city of Rochester, what are some of the programs that are thriving? What are the schools that have like these waiting lists that individuals around the county are interested in coming into RCSD to be a part of those school systems? So I think reading is definitely a priority. We push to fully fund foundation aid. And now the question is, what are the outcomes with these resources? We must push and call for parental involvement, and also feedback from the students, those that we're attempting to teach in our school systems. I think that best practices are when you're providing a service unto individuals and you hear from those who you're directly impacting on a day-to-day basis as to what's working for them and what's not working for them. If I could wave a magic wand of sorts, I would assure that all children had an IEP, you know, individual learning program that would focus on the individual and their learning skill set or their learning or the best way of learning for that individual.
You and I spoke recently about District Attorney Sandra Dorley. I don't want to press that point. I want to ask you about a separate story that the Democrat and Chronicle reported on today. And this is their reporting. It is not mine. It's not WXXI's. I don't know I haven't read every inch of the report on this, the police report, but they contrasted the district attorney refusing to be pulled over and what happened in her case, which is now just about everybody knows now, with a black man in Rochester who was being pulled over. He stopped within about a tenth of a mile of where he was asked to pull over to the curb, but the officer deemed that wasn't fast enough. And eventually they broke his window and pulled him out of the car to the curb. And the response that they're contrasting was so different. Do you look at stories like that and think, fortunately, that's a one-off and that is not common? Do you think there's still a very different standard of justice? And if so, what work has to be done?
There absolutely is a different standard of justice. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. When I look and just talk to individuals from the community, sometimes you'll hear these stories as to why we don't see as many African-American or Hispanic police officers. And often there's this story of, oh, well, they're not interested in being members of the police department because of community police relations. Well, I've talked to and I know a number of people that sought the opportunity to become police officers. I think there's also a difference when you have police officers who are from a community and live in the community and also reflect those in which they serve. All too often, you know, members in black and brown communities experiences with some members of RPD has been comparable to being ruled by an occupying force of sorts. You know, when you look at the numbers, like 94-96% of police officers do not live in this community. And I think there's a need for more active engagement with those in which you serve because you're able to build a relationship. You build a relationship with the grandparents, with the parents, with the young men and young women in the community, and there's a different type of policing. And I just, I don't know what manner that individuals are taught to actually engage members of our community, but at times it reflects poorly, and it's in a manner as if those who they engage are less than, opposed to a human being.
All right, about 30 seconds. You bring up residency. In our last half hour, Michael Geraci, who's running for city court judge, said that he lives in Rochester. He wants to be a city court judge. He thinks that if you serve in Rochester, you ought to live in Rochester. You're saying the same thing on the police side. Is there a legislative solution in Albany for that to require that? I don't really know how that would work.
Yeah, I don't know the bill offhand, but I know that my colleague Sarah Clark introduced legislation calling for members of the police department to live in the Rochester community.
And you'd want to see more of that.
Absolutely. I think it changed the dynamics. When you live in a community, you have positive relationships in that community. And even when you look at some of the neighborhoods where members of our police department do live, really nice neighborhoods, you know, subtle, and they have positive relationships with their neighbors.
I appreciate you being here. We invited both candidates for this seat who are on their primary ballot coming up, Demond Meeks and Willie Lightfoot, to be here. Did not hear back from the Lightfoot campaign. Perhaps that'll change, but thank you for being here. We appreciate
your
time.
I appreciate you, Evan.
Demond Meeks, votedemondmeeks.com is his website if you want to learn more. Running for re-election in the 137th district there. Our thanks to Michael Geraci in the first half hour and to you for listening from the whole team at Connections. Thank you very much. We'll be back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.